When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's episode 40 of the LSQ podcast, The Big 4-0. I'm your host, Jenny LSQ. I had the pleasure of visiting Bad for Lashes' Natasha Khan at home in Los Angeles last fall, shortly after she had released her fantastic new album, Lost Girls. And it was just so lovely to finally get to dig in with an artist whose music has always had such emotional resonance for me, and who before I'd only gotten to speak to briefly. In this conversation, you'll hear Natasha talk about some of the 80s sounds that inspired Lost Girls, and how it ties into the music she heard growing up in the UK. By the way, she's about to start a North American tour, so yeah, go see that if you can. In fact, I think the first show is tonight if you're listening to this episode when it's really just fresh in the world. Also, since Best Coast are on the verge of releasing a new LP, I'm going to feature, like, a microdose from the LSQ interview with Bethany Cosentino from a couple of years back, episode 13. But we'll get to that later. Okay, back to Natasha. I had run into her in LA a few years ago when she was here for, like, a long getaway, and I guess she decided she really likes it here because she never really left, so that is where we begin.
Yeah, I do really like it. I think it's weird because I go through phases. Like, you know, I'm sure when you're here for long enough, you miss... That's the train that goes by our house, which is Ned. Very New York, actually. I'm living under the JMZ at the moment. Yeah, it's pretty loud. I can shut the door if...
No, it's cool.
So I go through phases where sometimes I really miss London, and I'm going through a bit of that phase at the moment because everyone's saying that the leaves are turning and the jumpers are coming out and the fireplaces are going on.
It's jumper season.
Jumper season, and like Strictly Come Dancing's back on TV, and I'm like, no, I'm so depressed. but no, I think the reason, obviously, I've been here for almost 3 years because I made the album. I found some great collaborators. It's been really easy and fun to make visual work, painting, videos, you know, there's a
lot. But is this truly the first time you've lived away from home for this long, or did you?
I think for this long, yeah, because I did live in New York in 2007. I was there for about a year.
Right.
But I guess this is the longest I've been away.
This is the longest you've sort of relocated. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was so intrigued when I first saw you posting some of the initial videos for Lost Girls, and you know, at first watching it, it's like, oh, what is this? Is this going to be? And as it turned out to be the beginning of the new album rollout, I was curious whether the idea for those concepts preceded the music or vice versa. I mean, at what point in conceptualizing this collection did where's the cart and where's the horse? Is it the music or the sort of overall ideas?
I feel like the overall narrative was something that started to work its way into my imagination pretty early on moving here. I was taking long drives with a guy called Jason who worked at B-Real Films, who they represent me for like commercial work and short films and stuff. But we'd been kind of taking these long drives over to the office on the west side, and we talked a lot about underground music, like subcultures, tribal, you know, how things had changed from the 90s when we were growing up, and, you know, you'd go to your local record shop and they'd save records for you and tell you about certain things that they knew you'd be into. And there was very much like this personal aspect to whatever musical scene you're into, and it was pretty underground. And we were saying how now with the internet that things don't really stay underground anymore; they're just exposed immediately, and they don't really get that time to mature and gain flavor and kind of percolate. And so when we were doing these drives, because I was saying, you know, I really come here to sort of make films, and we were talking a lot about Trump and like the border stuff was happening and the Women's March was happening and all these sort of political things going on. Also living in Highland Park and being surrounded by Mexican culture and Hispanic culture and all the families. And so I started to write this story about this gang of girls that came from over the border and were like these mystical beings, and what would happen if they came to downtown LA. And so the script and the story was being fleshed out. So when I started making the music, I already had a universe.
Right.
And I was
Interesting though, because as you say, you also do separately film project. There are extra album things that you do. And so this series of ideas, it could have been, you could have turned it into something else and not have it become the basis of the next album. So how did it begin to evolve into the songs? And were you here in this space where we're sitting now when you actually started writing music?
We can shut. Do you want to shut the door?
Yeah, maybe we'll shut the door.
I think we should shut the door
a little bit.
Yes.
I mean, you must have felt the same kind of personal connection to this concept and to the idea of these lost girls and the beginning of the album idea to delve into making songs about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with every album, I'm sort of living a narrative or a story initially anyway. And that's how, I think that's like a creative tool I use to kind of, just to get myself located in a space where I can write lyrics and understand where these characters are coming from and what this music might be feeling like. But it always meshes in with real life. So the first song I wrote was Kids in the Dark, just in one day in a studio with Charles Scott, who I ended up co-producing the record with. And we'd been set an assignment to do a piece of music for a TV show. Mm-hmm. And they said they just wanted to locate it in like the mid-80s. And so we set up some crazy old synths and arpeggiators and all this stuff. But what happened was, at the time I was falling in love and feeling very romantic about LA and driving around at night time, holding hands, you know, like feet on the dashboard, looking at the sunset, like that sort of vibe was in my personal life. And then this story on the side of that was kind of surrounding that, this location, these girls, this place. So when I started playing the synth and the chords that I chose and the beats and the feeling of it was this fuzzy, overwhelming, like make-out music.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the 80s thing, obviously, it became... Once you started messing around with those keyboards, that sound, you dug it. Because you're a little younger than me, but we were kids in the 80s, and so it's like... It's interesting what those sounds what those specific sounds, those keyboards and those touchstone elements of 80s music, what they conjure, you know, I guess I always think like Phil Collins, when I think like listening to your record, I was like, ooh, this is like got a little bit of that sweet Phil Collins shit going on to it.
Yeah. And it's funny because there's a lot of the 80s guys that I was referencing and thinking about that are English, like Peter Gabriel, Phil Collins, David Bowie, who did Addicted to Love? Robert Palmer. Was he American? I can't remember, but I felt like there was sort of this, the 80s sound that I grew up with was definitely fed by the Goonies and Steven Spielberg and E.T. and all of that Karate Kid and 80s American romance. But then there's this strange 80s thing that's like Terry Gilliam, Labyrinth.
Right.
Like all the weird kids films that were very... that were done in Ealing Studios, you know, like very odd
creepy
synth sounds. And then mix that again with being in LA and thinking about Lynch and the Halloween soundtrack, John Carpenter. Like, it's just, I feel like the sounds we were choosing, everything I was hearing, we'd flick through things and I'd be like, that one. And I don't know why. I can't locate it specifically in my mind, yeah. But we all feel those sounds as something very nostalgic and sentimental. And I think, like you say, it conjures a lot just from one synth sound, you can just be placed somewhere.
When you were a kid growing up, you know, in the 80s, what were some of the pieces of music that were reaching you where you were that really hit you? I mean, were you hearing Phil Collins and Peter Gabriel and all that stuff as a kid growing up?
Well, it was definitely on the radio. I remember watching, like, the Brit Awards, which is, like, our crappy version of the MTV Awards, but seeing Peter Gabriel come on and do Give Me Steam, like, that Steam song, and he'd yeah. dressed up in a giant muscle man suit, and it was so bizarre. Like, he's the weirdest performer, and I loved it. I remember we taped it on a videotape, and I remember re-watching that. Bjork Unplugged was on MTV, you know, and then, well, I guess that's the 90s, but I'm trying to think. In the 80s, there was just Beverly Hills Cop was on TV all the time, E.T. was on TV all the time. You know, Michael Jackson, I went to see do the Bad Tour when I was 9.
Wow.
My mum and I went out and bought True Blue by Madonna when I was, that was my
Wait,
first
Let's go back
record.
To the Michael Jackson thing for a minute, though. So yeah. 9 years old, you got to see Michael Jackson.
At Wembley Stadium doing the Bad concert.
And was that I'm guessing your mom was into it too.
Yeah, so my mum was 21 when she had me.
Right.
And so when, in the 80s, she was like 30, which is so young.
Yeah.
And we experienced that whole pop music thing. Well, I experienced it through her as a lover of music and as a young woman in England in the 80s. So we always had the radio and we were always singing along to Chaka Khan and Luther Vandross and Alexandra and like all that sort of soul,
right.
cheesy kind of soul music that like The Wave plays now on the radio all the time. Like that's my favorite radio station in LA because yeah. it plays Billy Ocean. And like, but yeah, so that was, you know, a huge part of growing up. And I was hearing Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel and family parties. They would play Donna Summer and, you know, it was just very much my mum now is like into Rihanna and like, you know, she's always into what's happening now. She's very up to date.
Yeah.
So I guess in the 80s, she was just really super up to date with giant shoulder pads and permed hair. And yeah.
Did she ever do anything musical herself or does she sing or?
She sings in a choir now, which is really sweet. But I think she's like an unexpressed creative person because she's super smart and very musical. And we had music in the house growing up all the time or in the car. It was always on and she had a big record collection. She was really into Northern Soul as a young girl. She had a crew cut, like, you know, she was into this different scenes and
right.
dancing.
At what point did you start to notice that music wasn't just what was around, but that it was something that you cared about a lot? Like, what were the first things you really gravitated toward with, like,
my know, soul?
With your, yeah, where you're like, oh, shit.
It was probably, oh, shit. I mean, I'd say it was, like, Joni Mitchell and James Taylor early on. Because I just loved that Americana sort of songwritery sound. And then as I got a bit older, I just got obsessed with Kurt Cobain. And when I was a teenage girl, I used to lie out on my patio in like a green mohair cardigan and look at the stars and just was convinced that I was communicating with him. And
maybe
just,
you were.
And just watch his live, because he died when I was, I guess I was like 14 or 13.
Yeah.
And I remember it being announced on the radio and then MTV went crazy with showing Courtney Love, like bringing the suicide note down to all the fans and there were documentaries and then they'd do like an evening of Nirvana stuff and it would be Unplugged and then Live in Utero show and then like, a, you know, them, was it like them with Sonic Youth on tour, that amazing...
Right.
Punk, like,
the
I can't
year
remember.
Punk broke, yeah,
yeah, the year punk broke. So as a young girl, I was just like obsessed.
You were already a fan when Kurt passed.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that I mean, was that an emotional thing for you?
It was terrible.
I had to go home from work that day.
Yeah.
I was like in college and I had a part-time job that I was at that day and it came on the radio and I couldn't stay at work anymore.
It's the same. The main people that I've loved, I've always heard it on the radio late at night, which is so weird. Like, so I was sitting up in bed in my teenage bedroom listening to the radio and then it came on the news at like midnight or something. And I was so sad. And then the next day at school, I took all my poetry books in with me. And I just remember writing like poems about how I was feeling. There weren't that many kids at school that were into it.
Right.
So I remember being really sad and felt just so lonely and weird about it. And then River Phoenix around that time, I remember hearing that on the radio. And then years later, I heard on the radio when Michael Jackson died and I cried.
Yeah.
I mean, I could cry now just thinking about it because for me, regardless of everything that's come out about Michael Jackson recently, but at the time when I was 9 and then all through my life up until that point that he died, he soundtracked every family party, every friend party, every relationship, every holiday. Like, his music just permeated our life as a family.
Yeah.
And it was those artists that I gravitated to, Michael Jackson, Bowie, Kate Bush, because they introduced theatre and film and narrative into the work, and they were such fully fledged people that they presented universes to us. It wasn't just like a band wearing jeans, playing whatever. Like, I loved that, but as I grew older, I realised that I wanted to be a storyteller and I wanted to work with archetypes and mythology and characters, and these people were just blowing my mind as a kid. And talking about the 80s, that was a time when society pushed those people up to the fore and they were celebrated for their uniqueness and weirdness and crazy, you know, and also following them through phases of their career where they just really changed and evolved.
I know, it's funny to hear you say that. It's like we kind of forget what a great era it was for artists like that and for artists in general to be able to be that weird on such a huge platform,
like
as
the
early days of MTV
was
such a massive platform, such a mainstream platform, and that it was a platform for people doing such adventurous stuff, and that you got to see all those, you know, like Peter Gabriel and Talking Heads and all these
kinds of really trippy
things that...
Boy George, like, you know, like weird neo-romantics, Brian Ferry, Brian Eno. I mean, those costumes.
Yeah.
It's just insane to think that now when you watch...
Yeah, now that was the biggest era of music videos ever, and it was that weird.
We
should need to go back to that a little bit.
Yeah.
So what was the first creative thing you got immersed in that felt like... beginning to explore this kind of building a whole world with creative work? Was it music first, or did you have other kind of creative things that you...
Well, I thought when I was little I wanted to be a painter or a writer, and so that was I was working a lot with words and drawings, and then that always continued and still does. And then music came in because I was so shy about it. It took a lot longer for me to feel confident with that. But I guess the first time I put them all together was when I went to university, because I studied music with visual art. Mm-hmm. And in our year, there was music with visual art, dance with visual art, and theatre with visual art. And all of those disciplines, like the tutors made us mix everything up. So we would make pieces of music for the dance performance, or we'd paint a backdrop for the theatre thing, and like they would do something for our... So we were all kind of being treated as like a, almost like a, you know, like ballet russe company or something. You know, I think about it in that way, where those old ballet companies would bring on the best set designers, the best costume makers, the best composers, the best dancers, like, you know, and they would create a universe that was bringing in the talent, the sort of multidisciplinary talents of everybody to make this incredible stage piece. And I think that's the best way I can describe it. And they were always telling us to document and keep notebooks and draw things and make lists and use colour and, you know, to describe the music. And I mean, it was a beautiful way of looking at it, and I guess it just trained my brain from a really early age to that they're not separate, that all these disciplines and mediums are enhancing each other.
Right. And so tell me about an early kind of project of yours that kind of synthesized some of these things. Would it have just been kind of assignments at school, or before you started making your own records, were you writing and recording yourself singing?
Yeah, I was doing a lot of that, and I was working as a nursery school teacher. So I qualified as a childcare teacher, and I was doing that 4 days a week, and then I was living in Brighton by the sea with my boyfriend at the time, and on my days off I would just record music. And I guess the first time it all really came together was like the first show I did after university, and when I was a teacher, there was a place called the Permanent Gallery in Brighton that was run by really cool kids, and they would put on multimedia shows and exhibitions. And they asked me to create an exhibition, and then on the first night they opened, I did a live performance. So I made a wall full of hologramic light boxes that were kind of miniature 70s televisions, and then you would look through them and they had layers of perspex with lights behind and gels, different colored gels and drawings inside. So you'd kind of look into these hologramic universes, and they were a bit like film noir sort of comic books, because they had like comic book writing titles inside them.
Wow.
And then I made a bunch of miniature CDs of, say, four songs of my very early Backflashes songs, like Horror Show, and there was a song called Marilyn and Horror Show, and like weird songs I'd made. And I embroidered silk kind of CD cases, and they had a photograph of like these, of like little family members with sort of lightning bolts behind them, like E.T. style stills that I printed onto silk, and then I sewed around all the little faces and stuff and stuffed them. So they kind of became like these three-dimensional quilted CD cases.
Wow.
With terry cloth inside. It was like a production line, and I was making all this stuff for like a month before the show.
That's so cool.
And then I just played four songs, and everyone sat on the floor, and then everyone looked around the exhibition. And I did a bunch of drawings of the still of the little girl looking in the poltergeist TV, and Carrie holding her bouquet.
Did it immediately feel like a special zone? Was it immediately exciting once it all came together and you were looking at it?
It was exciting, but I was very nervous and shy. But it did feel like one of the first times that my vision was in the manifested world, as a reality. And when they gave me the little exhibition flyer, like it had all pictures of my artwork and a description that I'd written, and we had like weather sounds and thunder like just playing in the gallery, and it was just like all the things I loved and had been thinking about for so long.
Right.
And coming into like a product in a way, or just in objects that I could give to people or that they could look at.
And at that point, were you even looking at what you were doing as the beginning of doing music as a, you know, did it feel like the music was the focus yet even at that point? Or how did songwriting become the thing that you really zeroed in on?
The music was definitely the focus for me, because that was the most exciting aspect, was that all these things around were sort of paving a little yellow brick road to the music.
Right.
And then I started putting out little CDs all over Brighton and giving them to my favourite record shops to play to people, and I started doing shows. And then I guess what it went into just, it very sort of much concentrated on the music when I got my publishing deal, because they wanted me to make an album, and then I was part of the system of music production and producing records, and that timeline that is kind of generic and the way everyone gets treated is the same. But what they loved about me at the beginning was that I had this huge book that was just full of all the imagery and the ideas and the world of Fair and Gold, that first album.
Right.
And I think that's what kind of swayed them into giving me this deal.
Right.
There's a woman called Alison Armstrong who's still working in the music business, and she's a badass. And she was just like, Natasha, this book, this is you. This is what it's about. We don't see this. Like, this is very unique, and like, you've got to present this to the world, and this is what made it so special for us.
So wait, what happened to the book?
I've got it at home in England.
You've got it at home in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a source? Did that end up becoming a source of ideas for a minute at the beginning of putting up Afrolash's stuff?
Yeah, I think I'd kind of been building up all those themes and lists and images and ideas for probably 2 or 3 years or 4 years. So when the album came out, I just had too many ideas, like so much visual imagery. And each song I described, like all the instrumentation I wanted on it, how I'd do the production, what it would feel like. Each song had half a page of written work. And yeah, I was prepared.
Do you still do that kind of a practice? Do you still have notebooks where you draw and jot down things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got, if I could put all the notebooks I have in my life in a room, I'd probably fill up a room. Like,
wow.
There's so much stuff and so many ideas that sometimes I'll just go back to like 2003 and look in that notebook, and there'll be like a ton of film ideas or song ideas or lyric ideas that I never even used.
Wow. It must be interesting to look back at some of the earliest stuff and just as a mark of how much you've changed or matured since then. But I also, thinking about the new album and I guess your music in general, that one of the things I love about it is that there is that, it's like a tenderness for who you might have been as a younger person without, like, it's like showing us what you know now about, you know, the younger version of yourself or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think have been kind of some important creative breakthroughs that you've had? Because we've talked a little bit about the way your process has stayed the same, but what are some ways in which you've kind of learned, like, okay, here's what I need to do to bring it out?
Yeah, I think my kind of gathering information and ideas and that process has always been that kind of way for me. But I have to say, for each album, the execution has been very different. So, like, The Bride, the last album, I was driving around Woodstock and staying in a house on a mountain and kind of being surrounded by pine trees and creeks and thinking about all that sort of thing. And then this album was the opposite. It was warm, hazy, balmy nights, and moving to California, which is so different to Europe. And the light and the joy and the freedom I experienced here is kind of nothing I've ever really experienced before. But not even just because it was LA. I think it coincided with leaving a 10-year major record deal. I'm turning 40 in October. Like, you know, there's all these sort of, getting my dog, that changed me. You know,
yeah.
It broke my heart open in a way I can't really describe. And so I feel like this album, more than ever, I was just being really much more free, much more carefree, like not worrying so much, just choosing sounds I love, making beats I want to dance to. Like, there was really like a lot more joy and sort of liberation. And I think it comes through on the album. So I'm happy, because I think some of the other albums were just, up until this point, I'd been really concerned with like being of service and offering a cathartic experience for the listener and myself, and delving into some really deep shadow work and dark realms and very kind of difficult, painful, sensitive subject matter. And then with this one, I was like, I need to get back to that girl that saw Michael Jackson at 9 years old and sang into my hairbrush with my mum and brother and sister, and, you know, like, loves dancing and is in love and is happy. Like, some of those bits need to be shown and celebrated and shared, because I don't want everyone to think I'm just go to bed in a coffin every night, like, being really dark, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way artists who become associated with their music being cathartic for people, or especially for like sad catharsis, because I guess you can have, you know, I guess like your party, your EDM party albums are cathartic too, you know, that those artists get sort of yoked with this, like, you're supposed to make me sad and sadder every time. that, you know, if you want to make albums for your whole life, it's like the, it's not fair to be trapped to, that you have to be sad all the time, or that you have to, even artists, even the most extremes of that, like an Elliott Smith or someone like that, where it's just like,
you can't really go anywhere.
You can't, you don't, you know, where it's just like, you're not allowed to be happy or something. It's just like, you're required to commit to, you know, and bringing it back to Kurt Cobain too, where you're just no, it's not fair to ask that of our artists, that they be sad forever, or like,
you
get more and more dialed in on the, like, making us sad as their job, you know?
I agree. And I think that it's, I think you need to bring your audience along with you, and like you say, if you're going to do something for a lifetime, you have to evolve and grow, because otherwise it dies and it becomes a formula.
But also, it's just like, you are who you, as an artist, you are who you are, and it doesn't matter what kind of album you make, the trademarks of your sound and your music are going to be in there. It's just like, yes, you, I've listened to Lost Girls a bunch of times now, and I get what you're saying, but it is also sounds like it does make me sad. The songs are sad. There is plenty of sadness on the album, even as, even as something you consider a more on the more joyful end of the spectrum. It's like, you don't have to try for the things that are inherently in there. They're always going to be.
Yeah.
They're always going to be in there.
Yeah, like the exactly like the kind of prism that I see things through will always be colored by, you know, childhood experiences or heartbreak or whatever happened to me that makes me choose certain chords and sounds. Because to me, yeah, I love the happy sad combination, and I, you know, I like you say, I think I can't really help myself making those sorts of things, but the liberation that I felt in doing songs like So Good or Feel For You, like girl group sort of dancey things, was just so much fun. And and so I want to evolve and I want to grow, and I don't think an artist should have to conform to a specific label, because as we were talking about before, those artists we love, David Bowie, I mean, look at his Berlin album, and then he does like Let's Dance.
Yeah,
you know, it's like there's room. Lou Reed did some fucking such dark stuff, and then Take a Walk on the Wild Side, you know, like like even Take a Walk on the Wild Side's a great pop song, but it has the darkness, it has the backing vocals, it's talking about people taking heroin and drag queens and parties and all of that, like you say, but it's different prisms, it's different surfaces of a prism for me.
Yeah, I mean, and or even someone like Kanye or Bob Dylan, or you know, these artists who they change so drastically that it's like people get mad about it. But it's just like, no, can you imagine if in your thing you like to do the best, and for any average person, whatever you like to do the best, if you were forced to just keep doing it the same way every time, that wouldn't feel good. I want to talk to you a little bit about singing, and about, because obviously your singing voice is one of the signatures of your music, and it sounds like something that would have to have been developed in part as a technical skill, just because you have such a, you know, sort of beautiful, technically speaking, such a beautiful voice. Did you do training as a singer at all?
No.
How did you find did it come out sounding this way initially?
I mean, I did do training, but not in the conventional sense. So my training was to do with confidence, training myself to open up my chest and like loosen my jaw and learn how to project and things like that, because my voice is very airy. There's a lot of breath in my voice. And early on, I kind of sang into myself like this and felt very shy. And I'd run out of breath quickly because I didn't have any diaphragm kind of control or strength, because I didn't understand how it worked. I was self-taught on everything. And then when I went to university, we had this teacher called Juliet who used to make us lie on the floor, and you'd breathe in for 8, hold for 10, breathe out for 12, like these sorts of things. And what we didn't realise, but what they're actually doing is they get your parasympathetic nervous system kicked in, so you calm down and you're not so anxious and nervous. They get you to expand your lungs and increase your lung capacity. And then as you're breathing out, you're kind of, your diaphragm's like pushing up and you're tensing your stomach. So all these things we were doing, I didn't really realise, but they were helping me in the background. And then I did just sort of develop my own singing voice. And then when I started doing live shows, sometimes I'd lose my voice. And I remember one time I got such a sore throat that I had to take, like, I couldn't sing, and they gave me some steroids so that I could, like, get through the show. And I was like, this sucks. And so,
Natasha.
Yeah. And it was ridiculous. I was like, this is like Beyonce shit here. But I actually, probably on my, I think it was on my third album, I met a guy called Don Lawrence who works in New York, and he teaches Lady Gaga, and he did PJ Harvey, and he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
And I only ever saw him two or three times, but he recorded our sessions on my phone, and I still use those now to warm up before shows, because you're kind of being an athlete, and basically you have to protect your vocal cords by clearing them of mucus and warming them up and exercising them, so they're stretching, and they're just muscles. And if you don't do that, if you go on a 2-month tour and you don't do that, I can't, I wouldn't be able to do it. So I have exercised my the biceps of my vocal cords now for a while. But I didn't like sing, I don't sing all the time. You'd think if you're a singer, like you just walk around singing all the time. And me and my boyfriend sing a lot in the car and stuff like that, but I'm not practicing my vocal exercises when I'm not doing shows or recording. So I just started, because my first show's in like a month. But it comes back pretty quickly.
Where does the tour start?
In the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so you'll be back for jumper season and
be back for some cold, cozy November stuff. Yeah.
Maybe you could be a future guest on Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah. Oh my God, that would be hysterical.
I'm pitching it right
now.
Yeah,
okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, some people you can just feel that they had to be an artist. Like, it's just in their spirit, in their energy. And Natasha has that for sure. I was actually in the process of editing this episode, because the interview happened last fall. But then just the other day, I was driving here in L.A., and she was walking down the street, walking her dog, wearing overalls and a baseball cap, and my heart exploded. Anyway, as I mentioned earlier, Bad for Lashes are on the road now with dates until late February, and you can find out more at badforlashes.com. Next up, looking back a couple of years to 2018 and episode 13, lucky number 13 of the LSQ podcast, I wanted to feature an excerpt from that interview with Best Coast's Bethany Cosentino in honor of the impending arrival of her new album. Best Coast's fourth studio LP, Always Tomorrow, comes out later this month. And in this clip, Bethany talks about being in the midst of a much-needed creative break.
It's been very interesting, because this is the longest amount of time where we haven't put something out, but like, there was a period of time where people were just like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm literally just living my life. Like, I'm writing music, I'm not writing music, I'm like hiking with my friends. This is literally the first time I've lived I'm at home life. Like, I haven't been able to do this in so long that I really feel like I needed this before I could really get back into the mindset of making another record. Like, I'm single for the first time in my adult life. I have like most of my closest friends are people I grew up with that I've like reconnected with. I'm sober. I'm like, so much in my life has changed that I just feel like I needed just to take some time off to just be like, you know what? I'm not gonna force another record out. I'm not gonna just like do what I've already done. I'm just gonna sort of like push the pause button, continue to like work, but just sort of like go at it at a snail's pace. And some people are just like, they can't handle it. And they're like, where's the record? And I'm like, dude, just chill. Like, the record will happen. And in the meantime, there's a billion other people putting music out.
Yeah.
You know? So I just feel like sometimes you have to like really pay attention to what's going, like, as a creative person, you have, as a person in general, but especially as a creative person, you have to pay attention to like what is going on inside of you so that you can like actually create something great.
Yeah, if you don't, you legitimately don't have to until you're ready. You know?
Yeah. And I feel like I'm finally, like I said, I'm finally like, I understand that and I'm okay with it. And I've gotten to be, I've gotten past the whole, like, because I used to just take everything. Jesus.
Josie's going.
I used to take everything so damn personally. And I feel like now I just understand where it's like, you know, now a like kid yelling at me that their album isn't done doesn't affect me the way it would have like 4 years ago. Because 4 years ago I would have been like, yeah, I know. And I would have been And now I'm just like, who fucking cares? Like, there's a mute button for that, you know? So, yeah. And like, it's complicated too, because this is my job. Like, I don't have another job. It's like, when I'm not touring or making records, I'm not like working some other job. So I had to kind of compromise and say like, okay, this is going to mean that I'm not going to be making as much money as I'm used to. This is going to mean that I'm not going to be like, this is going to mean that I have to like readjust to being a person that's like, yeah, I'm home. Like, most of my friends are like, you're here. I'm like, I'm here. Like, you're not used to it, but here I am, you know? But I feel like that was like very essential. And the record and the songs that I'm writing are very like reflective of that. And you'll definitely be able to tell that like, oh, this girl went through some shit and she came out on the other side. And she took a break that was like much, much needed. So
yeah,
I feel like refreshed.
You know, we're just glad she's back, baby. Look for that new Best Coast album in stores and online later this month. And they're on the road extensively this spring and summer as well. Thanks again to Natasha and Bethany for their time and for being rad. And I've got upcoming episodes with Tune Yard's Meryl Garbus, Phosphorescence Matthew Howe, Group Love's Hannah Hooper, and more. Subscribe, for crying out loud. And if you want to reach me with questions or feedback, etc., I'm at JennyLSQ. Thanks so much for listening.